Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello. I'm Patrick Riley, and this is New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with LaDale Winling, Associate Professor of History at Virginia Tech University, about his new book, Building the Ivory Tower, Universities and Metropolitan Development in the 20th Century, released in 2018 by University of Pennsylvania Press. In its pages, Winling tracks six universities morphing from turn-of-the-century products of real estate speculation to city-shaping property management firms. The chapters reconstruct how university administrators schmoozed with state officials to win military research contracts, devised new legal means to maintain racial segregation, and directed knowledge production in the service of capital. LaDale also speaks about his ongoing digital project on redlining called Mapping Inequality. A link to the project is on the New Books in History webpage for this episode. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, LaDale. Thanks for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering if you can begin by telling us a little bit about how you came to this project.
Yeah, absolutely. I was, in fact, an undergraduate at Western Michigan University, a history major, and a couple of, we'll say major student parties in local neighborhoods broke out and, in fact, kind of spilled into violence where police were called and then repelled and then a riot squad was brought out. And this sparked really significant and acrimonious a political response from the city of Kalamazoo. And I thought, I was a senior in college, and I thought, geez, this is, unbelievable, unprecedented, it seemed to me. And I actually wanted to read about university city politics, and this is in 2000, 2001, 2002, and actually did not find much in the university library on universities and kind of city politics or urban history. And so this kind of stuck with me over the course of my master's program, and then I realized that this is something that there was a gap in the literature that I could fill with graduate research, but not just a gap, that there was very little of this kind of overlap or interface between urban history and the history of higher education. And so sparked by these kind of events at my undergraduate institution, it set me on a path which I think helped to make that bridge between higher education and urban history.
Great. And I'm also curious how you came to choose the case studies that you did, because as you note in the book, the processes that you cover were happening all over the country. Suburbanization, increasing federal support for university expansion, and as you just mentioned, struggles between community groups universities and state, local, and federal governments. So what drew you to the universities that you studied in the book?
So pretty broadly, while I was a graduate student, I took a dissertation kind of prospectus course with my graduate advisor, Robert Fishman. And he said, whatever you do, like, make sure it's important. Make sure it matters, and you don't need to be too modest in your ambitions for both your dissertation and then with an eye towards the eventual book. And so I thought, maybe I'll write the history of, you know, this kind of like the interaction between these two types of institutions over the course of the 20th century. How am I going to do that? The standard, I think, in urban history is to use a case study. And I thought that would have been a little bit too modest, that if I was going to have the broad ambition of telling the history of higher education and kind of urban history and politics and development over the course of the 20th century, one university and community wasn't going to cut it. And so kind of parceled thought about how individual eras in terms of political governance, in terms of economic development, in terms of trends and capacity in higher education would lend themselves to the selection or finding a kind of representative institution or partnership kind of interaction between a university and a city. All of that is background to that selection process. And I also got the very good advice from graduate advisors that if you can write about a place that is already known to a certain extent, it'll help you. If you can kind of put a new layer or a new lens upon a place that people already care about, then half of your work is done for you. And so that's in part what the logic was behind the selection of Ball State University and Muncie, Indiana. The work of Robert and Helen Lind in the Middletown studies, I think, had put that on that institution and that community on the map among humanists and social sciences. I'm a man who loves Chicago, and my late first wife taught at Northwestern, and while I was a candidate in graduate school, and so a Chicago area institution seemed like a no-brainer. And because Arnold Hirsch had done the work, had a chapter in Making the Second Ghetto on the University of Chicago, it was a bit foolhardy, but also a sign of my kind of pragmatism in the midst of this ambition to kind of follow up and extend that work on the University of Chicago, Hyde Park, and the South Side of Chicago more broadly. I played a hunch with in the selection of the University of Texas and Austin, Texas. And I knew this was a kind of growing Sunbelt city and institution in the era of the 20s, 30s, 40s, and into the 50s. And, you know, I figured there was some kind of overlap. There was some kind of intersection between the political work as first a congressman and then as a senator of Lyndon Johnson and the University of Texas and Austin urban development. And so I applied for a grant and got out to the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library and Archives on a hunch, and it fortunately paid off because I realized then that the Balcones Research Center was in fact part of the product of the political work and the process of bringing home federal resources by Lyndon Johnson. You know, Berkeley in the 1960s, this is one that kind of everybody knows in some fashion. And extending that analysis to issues of university expansion, urban development, was kind of a no-brainer. That's what I did for the dissertation, and then for the research on the book project, I wanted to bring it up to date to the 2000s, and so I had kind of shied away from Ivy League type institutions, but you know, the resurgence and the transformation of Cambridge within Metro Boston, and the kind of rivalry but also collaboration between MIT and Harvard University were a very compelling example of the engagement of universities in this kind of new economy, driven in part by Dole Act and licensing and commercialization of research, but then also their work in partnership with redeveloping urban centers in a new way, in this new wave in the 90s, 2000s, and then now the 2010s. I should say about Ball State and Muncie, I mean, in fact, when I was thinking about going to graduate school, I wanted to write something on Kalamazoo and Western Michigan University. And, you know, I had to give up on that dream. I didn't think, or I came to realize or came to believe that, you know, I would not find much purchase thinking about an impactful dissertation and a impactful book that one mid-sized university and one mid-sized city would kind of grasp or arrest the attention of the historical, you know, historical community. And so I wanted to maintain that kind of commitment or include a kind of modestly sized city and a kind of scrappy upstart institution of higher education. And so I was definitely, I'm very happy and kind of maintain that, whatever, loyalty to an underdog or less celebrated type institution in including Ball State and Muncie, even though in the grand scheme of higher education institutions, Ball State is, you know, pretty high up on the ladder of research orientation and enrollment and so forth. But I wanted to at least extend or gesture towards some kind of representative and an inclusive reckoning with medium-sized cities, medium-sized institutions.
Did you find it challenging then on the level of writing or analytical synthesis to take these disparate narratives and these kind of relationships that university administrators across the country have with their local governments, their state governments, the federal government, and kind of make a bigger picture?
Heck yes. It was really difficult. And, you know, what you see on the printed page, I hope is modestly successful. But that's probably the 10th or 12th, you know, basically full draft since I started the project as a dissertation. And at basically every point of review, whether it was graduate advisor and dissertation, whether it was the first readers for the university presses that I submitted to, or whether it was the editor at University of Pennsylvania Press, kind of looking at revisions, everyone said, you've got to do more to tie these together. You've got to make sense, like help us see this, these individual cases as more of a broader story, which is what I wanted to do. But it took a good deal of writing and rewriting and rethinking how one led into another in terms of chapter transitions, in terms of shifting and overlap in historical eras, in terms of the way that the institutions drew upon first local and then federal resources, as well as trends in urbanization, urban development, dealing with fiscal issues, urban renewal, as well as challenges of demographic change, economic change, and so forth. One thing, maybe two things that helped in that process of bringing these disparate cases together on the university side was that over the course of the 20th century, leading education administrators increasingly shared ideas and then developed public policy together. So they shared practices. They thought of themselves as a set of shared institutions with interests in common. And so looking at organizations like the AAU, like the ACE, were useful in understanding how university administrators at different universities thought of themselves as part of a shared enterprise. And by the same token, when thinking about cities, the increasing capacity and the increasing engagement with the federal government and federal resources brought to cities, whether it be in the Great Depression and the New Deal, or during mid-century and post-World War II urban redevelopment funds or tax credits, the federal government engaged all of these cities in kind of shared ways or with a commonality that helped me see them as part of a broader narrative, or helped me write these in a way that I hope can help audience members and readers understand these as part of a broader set of trends.
On that note about the ACE and these other organizations of universities and colleges, I'm wondering if that was not tempting for you to go and look at those records. I think, you know, as you were discussing the deliberation over each case study, it became apparent to me that narrowing down the source base must have been one of the most difficult parts of this project, because one can always go into the social history of a neighborhood or a city deeper. So that's one, you know, you could dig down deeper, but you could also, I imagine there would be also the temptation to kind of track this idea of universities as a lobby, as an increasingly self-conscious constituency. Yeah,
absolutely. And so I didn't use the ACE archives, for example, and there were few national institutions where I went to their archives. And in part, that was a kind of pragmatic choice about where did I have money and time to spend and travel. And during graduate school, during coursework, a professor said, Maris Vanofskis at the University of Michigan, he had said he had written a book on the history of Head Start. And he said, well, I probably had about two more years of research that I could have done, but I had enough research to write the book. And that stuck with me, that idea that you can write, I think, a meaningful book and one that makes a compelling case that holds together and does a lot of things without having looked at every document, every place. And in terms of thinking about my research as like coming together in a book, you know, the way I try to think about it now is that I want to do enough research to write a book that people want to read and that they will find it compelling and convincing and interesting. And, you know, I don't think you get any points for going beyond that or writing, you know, looking at every document or researching spending time in every archive, you know, just to confirm something that you already know. So I think everybody has to make a set of pragmatic choices, largely in service of the thing you're producing. For me, it was a book. In other cases, I had other research or siphoned some of the research off to articles and other efforts. But that certainly was a consideration. Now, I mean, I will also say, you know, many of the university archives that I looked at had a good number of publications and some of the relevant documents in the president's papers. So, for example, Lawrence Kimpton, who worked with both the American Council on Education, a subcommittee therein, and the Association of American Universities, he led, he was the chancellor of the University of Chicago in the 1950s. He led initiatives in both the AAU and the ACE in organizing urban universities to lobby for, write, and then support and implement urban renewal funding and urban renewal programs. And so to get that aspect of the story, both to tell the University of Chicago side of the story and to tell the national story, I just needed to look at the Kimpton papers at the University of Chicago because he was involved in all of those conversations. And so it was a what I usually call like a cheap or an economical way to get into that national conversation without having to have, you know, months of research at the ACE in Washington, D.C., for example, which I tried to get into, but actually couldn't.
That answers a question that I was very curious about, which was the transportation of different policy and legal methods of seizing property and remaking it as the universities saw fit. A very important actor in the book is Julian Levy, the University of Chicago alum and attorney who advised Kimpton as to their urban renewal schemes. And it was via these mechanisms, I'm assuming, that Levy's legal means of remaking university neighborhoods traveled across the country to places like Berkeley and places like Cambridge. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Julian Levy, that guy was so impressive and such an evil genius. You know, I read a few kind of paragraphs about him in Arnold Hirsch's book, and so kind of knew the basics of him. But he was the executive director of the Southeast Chicago Commission, SECC. And he also taught at the University of Chicago. His grandfather was one of the founders of the University of Chicago. He was really tightly woven into the fabric of the University of Chicago. And he led, or they described the SECC as the urban renewal arm of the university. And I got to say, the urban renewal programs were almost single-handedly created by Julian Levy, first to serve the purposes of the University of Chicago, and then as a means of building national support for those programs or those ideas. He kind of like extended those and included a wide array of other universities and communities into a national coalition to get the legislation passed. And then he did some consulting with places like Carnegie Mellon, as well as MIT and a number of other universities around the country to say, this is the new urban renewal program that I created, and this is how you, university administrators, can draw upon them. So they circulated through these kind of special committees at ACE and AAU. And then Julian Levy did that kind of side consultation to teach university administrators like himself how to use those. I cannot say enough good and bad things about Julian Levy. I should say, in terms of the kind of compromises and challenges of doing archival research, the then executive director of the SECC, when I was in graduate school, would not let me into their archives. He said, without letting me see any kind of finding aid, he said, let me know what you want, and I'll let you see it. And I was like, I don't know, like, how could I possibly know what I want? I don't know what you have. However, Levy and Kimpton were in contact, not just Kimpton, but his successor, George Beadle, who was a Nobel Prize winning geneticist, and then Beadle's successor, Edward Levy, who was Julian Levy's brother, all chancellors and presidents of the University of Chicago. But especially with Kimpton, Julian Levy was in contact via memo with Lawrence Kimpton every single day, and I would say not infrequently 2 to 3 times a day in printed form, probably more via telephone, but almost everything that Levy did was hand in glove with Lawrence Kimpton and the leadership of the University of Chicago, and so the very robust U of C University archives attested to all of Levy's activities. And so I was able to kind of tell that story from the U of C archival repository and their holdings.
That's a great circumvention of a problem of access.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you were able to do something similar with the property management firms that UChicago set up to manage its growing portfolio of rental properties, or were those sources not in the university archives?
Some of them were. They were in a variety of forms. So there were a number of listings of properties that were up for purchase. In the 50s and then the 60s, University of Chicago wanted to buy properties first, like south of the Midway, and then throughout Hyde Park and Woodlawn, to we could charitably say stabilize the neighborhood, to kind of arrest the demographic transformation of the expansion of the Black Belt and African Americans into those two communities. Uncharitably, we could say they wanted to keep Black people out, or to manage the segregation of the buildings and blocks and neighborhoods in Hyde Park and Woodlawn. So there were documents that indicated address by address by address what was up for grabs, or up for purchase, or under consideration. There was also photo documentation up to kind of the point of purchase. And then much of the material went over to McKee and Pogue and the various property management companies that the University of Chicago employed. And so it could be a little bit more difficult to track or to know exactly which properties we were talking about. However, I spent a ton of time at the Cook County Recorder of Deeds. And once I figured out that something called the Midway Properties Trust was a University of Chicago run institution to manage the properties, acquire them with a kind of arm's length relationship, it allowed me to figure out, or another way to figure out, what the university was buying with their capital campaign funds and their endowment, in a way that I could not get through the University of Chicago archives.
Wow.
I want to say, when I was in graduate school, Heather Thompson gave a couple talks at the University of Michigan. This is before she accepted a position there, when she was working on her book on Attica. And, you know, she said use the phrase detective work a number of times. And at that point, I thought, like, well, listen, I mean, is detective work really the most apt metaphor for what we're doing? I feel like we're, you know, bringing a great deal more kind of structural analysis upon, you know, the communities that we're writing about, et cetera, et cetera. And so I approached that with a little bit of skepticism. And, you know, like once I started doing my own archival work, I realized how right she was and became even more impressed with the kind of patience that she exhibited in researching the Attica book. You know, and she tells a story at the beginning of that about finally getting into this storeroom, kind of accidentally, almost sneaking in to find, you know, bloody shreds of fabric and clothes from the actual, riot and violence itself. I think it is both inspiring and impressive, but can also be useful, you know, like when you're out at sea and navigating without a compass in the archives, or maybe you don't even know like which archives are going to tell you what you want to know. Like, you need to have a North Star. And, you know, stories like Heather Thompson told were my North Star when I was like, where the hell am I going to find these property records? Like, who could possibly have kept this document? That it can be extremely tedious and time consuming and exhausting, but also extremely rewarding, to have that metaphor of detective work or that, those kind of examples to draw upon when you're kind of like losing your own, confidence, or you're losing your own kind of stamina in the archives or in the writing. And so that was very helpful for me.
Absolutely. And I think another method of maybe pinning down these elusive sources is kind of almost like neighborhood and amateur urban ethnography, and reaching out to other scholars who may work on the area. I'm wondering if you found that to be helpful, or if you found yourself kind of having a lot of conversations with local historians, other scholars who have done case studies, talking about their knowledge of the source space, and maybe even non-scholars about where exactly do we find the documents that we need.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the most rewarding things about this profession is the ability and the opportunities to kind of work in community and work in conversation with other scholars, whether they be faculty at universities, whether they be local historians, whether they be the researchers at local historical societies, because, you know, in almost every community and almost every case, you know, there were many people who knew the local story, the local source base, the local history better than I did, whether it was the university archivist, whether it was someone who had done a book on the development of particular subdivisions, or for me, there was an institution that was extremely helpful. The Urban History Dissertation Group at the Newbury Library, when I was a candidate and writing and living in Metro Chicago, the Urban History Dissertation Group was kind of a monthly meeting group of people who, many of whom, about half of whom, were either based in Chicago, and maybe another quarter were working on Chicago topics. And so the vast majority of people involved in that group were kind of at the same stage, had done research, whether it was a seminar paper or maybe they had come or spent some time in Chicago and knew Chicago pretty well. That was extremely, extremely useful. And then every place that I went to, kind of getting to know the people in the community, whether it was Austin or whether it was Berkeley or whether it was Cambridge, you know, any of the places, was essential. I remember there was somebody, there was a staff member at Stiles Hall, which was kind of a local YMCA institution, a community-oriented YMCA you know, kind of building and host for events. It was important in the 1960s and still important now for community outreach. And the program director, I talked with him. He gave me a bunch of great leads and information and angles and introductions. And then he upbraided me very severely that my research was not doing enough. I was not critical enough of the University of California, either as an individual campus in Berkeley or as a university, like a statewide university system. And, you know, really assailed my confidence just after, you know, giving me these great leads. And so that was also a kind of an interesting moment of adjustment or reckoning with how responsive I could be to local communities, but also whether I was confident enough in my own kind of ambitions and framework for the research project and the book. There was also, there were people in Hyde Park who, you know, would not talk to me. I think had such resentment over the work of the University of Chicago, as well as the many students, sociology or history or the kind of urban studies students who came to talk to them again and again, or had an extractive relationship with the community, who would say, like, you know, I'm not talking to another student, like, you know, do it yourself, buddy. That was also a challenge, but I think eye-opening in deciding or understanding what some of the pitfalls were of a community-engaged scholar.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, absolutely. I mean, to that point about the uneasy relationship between neighborhood residents and nearby universities and their faculty and their students, I'm wondering if, as someone who's been involved in public history, if you think that there would be a good way, or if you could say something about how universities might be more forthcoming about their historical role in segregating neighborhoods and discouraging political dissent, only because I feel like certain, you know, you think of a place like Berkeley, and they've almost used historical student and community protests to brand themselves as sites of edgy intellectual and cultural subversion. And I'm wondering if you think there's a way that that can be, that history can be used by the university, by universities in a more responsible way.
Yes. And I think the key is for it not to be led as an initiative by the central institution. The central administration of universities are fully wedded and responsive to the corporate entity. You know, they will always serve what they think are the specific short-term best interests of the university as a corporation, not the university as a set of communities or the university that is set within a broader community, unless there's a greater benefit to the kind of corporate body. And as an example of this, I think back to my PhD graduation. There was a university-wide graduation, and the president of the University of Michigan was talking about all the great things going on. And he said, the university, which was home to both like the birth of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, and Young Americans for Freedom. And, you know, that's just a sign of how we're able and willing to support students. And I thought, oh my goodness, like, this is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. And I scoffed in the stands of the football stadium at the time, because in my master's research, I read all about how university administrators wanted to, like, crush SDS, the local SDS chapter, and no time for, and were diametrically opposed to the interests of SDS. I anticipate, you know, University of Michigan was a little bit more open to the agenda of Young Americans for Freedom, but the fact that with a straight face, the university president could, like, brag that this was, that the University of Michigan was kind of like the birthplace, or, you know, one of the founding sites of these two organizations, was ridiculous to me, like, disgusting to me. And so, understand, you know, with a kind of clearer understanding of how university administrators work, I cannot say that I think a centrally university-led initiative to kind of share that history could do much good. But some of the other members of the university and education communities and the local communities can make it unavoidable. I think if faculty members or students or, you know, individual staff members conscientiously pursue this in concert with local community members, it can be an extremely meaningful and, I hope, non-co-optable or difficult to co-opt set of initiatives. And I would say not just on the question of like land acquisition and urban development, but all kinds of university engagement, whether it be something like for those universities with like hospitals and biomedical research histories, experimenting with and on local populations in the hospitals, I think is also an aspect that a number of universities must reckon with. And, you know, it's basically got to come from the bottom up, because it'll be more durable. It'll be less, and I hope it will be less likely to be twisted for corporate purposes or for marketing purposes. And so I think it's possible. And, you know, I think there are a number of models many of which would be difficult to scale or replicate, but it's got to be done more or less on like an individual or case-by-case basis, and almost without or against the wishes of the higher administration. I think the reckoning with universities and slavery, I think, is an example of this, that, you know, basically a place like Georgetown or a place like the University of Virginia could no longer avoid admitting their culpability, and then were forced to support support these research agendas and to support these kind of like outreach and, you know, and these beginning reparations efforts.
Yes. And I think another kind of struggle that overlaps between the university and the surrounding community that you cover in the book was around housing affordability. And you speak of the Student Proletarian Alliance that was formed in Berkeley, and also of the activism of the Congress on Racial Equality in Hyde Park in Chicago. And I'm wondering if you witnessed in the sources any of the kind of problems or hurdles to building those kind of coalitions, and if they are relevant for building new coalitions today, what would be those lessons?
So real quick, can you repeat the first part of the question? Like was it a real alliance? What are some of the obstacles and what are some of the lessons? Shall I take it like that?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think in a number of university communities in kind of the mid-century decades, whether it be the 50s, the 1960s, even a bit into the 1970s, we do see kind of real and meaningful and, you know, moderately enduring alliances between students as well as, you know, non-university members of the community. And we certainly saw this in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I did my some of my master's and PhD work, where I studied a major housing strike in the late 1960s, just about the same time as the rent strike in Berkeley, as well as there were rent strikes in Madison, Wisconsin. And these kind of preceded some of the kind of academic and student working class alliances in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the 1970s. I think these were real and also difficult to form and would be increasingly difficult now, but not impossible. I think in part, I mean, there was those institutions, you know, the top public and private institutions were able and willing to draw from a much broader segment of society in the 1950s and 1960s. It was much more common to have working class students as like a larger segment of the undergraduate population. And then, you know, in some cases, those working class students were, you know, like had a like lifetime affinity. They were working with their own people who simply weren't enrolled at MIT or Harvard or Wisconsin or Michigan or Berkeley. And, you know, that was in part enabled by the largesse and the capacity and the commitment of both states and the federal government to provide affordable higher education. And that's, you know, we're in a far different place from that now. So,
where there is affordable higher education and where there is, you know, a larger segment of the undergraduate and student population that comes from working class backgrounds, I think we can see very reasonable and very meaningful commitments and alliances. And I also think that there's got to be, you know, kind of two-way directions of action and sacrifice. You know, like something like a rent strike serves both, like undergraduate students, and non-university renters, like, serves both members of the university community, the gown part, and, members of the town part. There are a handful, I think, of ongoing efforts like this. Number one would be reactions against private policing units at places like Johns Hopkins or the University of Chicago, because, you know, like, university students don't want to get hassled, and you know, like, the people who often get hassled or brutalized are non-university members of the Woodlawn or Hyde Park community. And so this kind of alliance has to serve the non-university segments of the broader community. You know, it's the kind of funding models and the very difficult, like, level of accessibility and economic, like, feasibility of paying for higher education makes it real hard now. You know, basically, at the elite institutions, it's more expensive, and the students are either, they come from very, very privileged backgrounds, or they're in debt, you know, up to their necks. And I think they feel less of a willingness, and their whole life has been kind of lived in hock. And it's difficult to risk, you know, those student loans or those, you know, kind of repayment deferments. And it makes it harder to take direct action against a university or to take direct action against a police force, for example. You know, I think we're seeing maybe in the Black Lives Matter type protests, a greater willingness to risk, and people like Gene Demby and the NPR Code Switch podcast explored this. Like, basically, why are, you know, privileged white people willing to now put their bodies on the line, you know, against the police? And in fact, it's because, you know, some of their forms of privilege have been, you know, withheld from them. And for building this university and community alliance, you know, there's got to be a real eye to eye and shoulder to shoulder kind of level of commitment and identification that takes time to build.
That's great. Thank you. I'm also wondering if you think that the growth of the growth of campus police departments at some of these private universities and the administration more generally is how tethered that is to the university's role as a property holder. I would assume the relationship is very direct there.
Yeah, I think there is a pretty close relationship between property acquisition in the past, or the expansionary, we might even say, like, imperialistic relationship of universities to their surrounding communities, to their willingness and their ability to build private police forces to defend that territory. I mentioned Johns Hopkins and the University of Chicago, which are, you know, in some ways like the poster boys for these efforts. But a place that I taught for a year after graduate school, Temple University, also you know, they plant flags all around the edge of the institution, around the edge of campus, and they have, you know, they have in some ways drawn upon the model of the University of Pennsylvania in private policing, security forces, and kind of defending their borders, because they're, you know, they're fearful of, and they have a defensive attitude towards the surrounding communities. You know, like one of the fundamental ideas of my book is that universities have pursued knowledge at the expense of neighbors, right? We can think in a charitable or understanding fashion that, you know, universities are trying to serve national interests, in some cases global interests, in creating knowledge, in educating international students and educating American students for work internationally. And that means that they are far less responsive to the local communities. And in some ways, like, those national and international goals may be diametrically opposed to the interests of the local community. If a university administrator says, we want a strip of land for classroom buildings or dormitories or laboratories, it can be very difficult to, you know, to think for an administrator to think, you know, maybe another $10,000 or $100,000 of fair market value is appropriate. Or maybe we should build in some community resources to this new building that we're designing at the edge of campus. Clark Kerr, while he was still chancellor at University of California, Berkeley, before he was a system-wide president, made a presentation to the city of Berkeley's planning commission. And it said, he said, like, we have discovered the last three elements in the periodic table. We're doing fundamental scientific research of global importance that'll shape, you know, like, the limits of human knowledge. And if that means that we, you know, have to be a little less generous or a little less touchy-feely with some of the landlords around campus, then so be it. You know, he said, we've got other broader agendas to pursue. And I think that is illustrative of the mindset of universities in, we could say, balancing or pursuing one agenda over another. And how that relates to private policing is that if universities are unable to, say, control or heavily influence the practices of public or municipal police forces, then we could easily imagine how they shift to another idea that they've got to provide their own protection, whether it be for their students or for their property or for their well-being or their perceived reputation, which seems to be almost the highest value of a corporate university. I mean, I think ironically, you know, there's in almost every university community around the country, there is a question of the expansion of the university starving the municipality and the local government for resources. Basically, you know, nonprofit universities, in many cases, don't pay taxes on their campus land. And so that starves tax revenue from the municipality and local government to be able to provide social services and policing. And so universities, you know, in some cases, they can be compelled to provide what are called pilot payments, which is payment in lieu of taxes, to make up for the lost tax revenue. But, you know, that just gives resources away and cedes control to, you know, a democratic process. And I don't think university administrators particularly like that. So providing a private police force is a way to keep control of those resources, to maintain that reputation or that feeling of security, and to protect the borders of the land that they've already acquired.
The increasing resources of a lot of the biggest universities at the expense of the surrounding communities is a real striking contrast to moments in your book where you describe university administrators approaching state officials at various levels for assistance. And based on what you've just shared and based on kind of community struggles for universities to be more responsive to local needs, it seems now that certain community groups and individuals, local residents, almost have a relationship with universities like the universities once had with the state.
Yeah, in some cases, they have to kind of go hat in hand to universities to say, like, please, like, here's the evidence and here's the trouble that we face and that we hope you'll recognize in providing, you know, services to our community, whether it be lobbying for major pieces of transportation or civic infrastructure, or whether it be simply like sharing resources like open space, public parks, and things like that. I think universities, all the trouble and protests that they face, they deserve it and more. I mean, opening up university archives is a horrifying process. I mean, I recall when at the University of Chicago, I went into the folders where like the vice president of business operations was first in conversation with administrators at the Illinois Institute of Technology, which had just kind of developed an urban renewal strategy. And then the University of Chicago administrator said, like, this is great. Great ideas all around. This is something we need to do even more intensely. And it basically meant we need to acquire land and then not invest in it and not maintain it in order to create blight so that we can then raise it and bring in state and federal redevelopment money. Also, like side benefit, it will be extremely lucrative. And so seeing these like really disheartening and infuriating kinds of initiatives in the 1940s and 1950s, but also seeing them kind of play out in the 1970s in Cambridge, leads me to believe that, you know, just about every criticism that community members have offered, is justified and probably underplays the blame that universities bear in trying to pursue these global and national ambitions. But they, you know, they almost universally do it in a way that harms rather than helps the local community members. Like the best that we can say is that the stuff that follows displacement is fine or pleasant community resources or amenities. Who doesn't want to see the kind of new development in Boston in the Alston neighborhood where Barry's Corner once stood? But, you know, 40 years ago, like that was a working class kind of industrial and service oriented community. And, you know, like, why wouldn't that have been better to invest in rather than acquiring, displacing, and then redeveloping? You know, like given those options, you know, we should have kept Barry's Corner. Harvard could and should have kept Barry's Corner as it was, rather than, or building in infill rather than kind of acquiring secretly and then displacing and then, digging holes in the ground and then letting them sit for 5 to 10 years before they're able to build anything.
Now that you've kind of sharpened your critique of universities through the research and writing of this book, I'm wondering if it's affected the way that you engage in campus and campus adjacent politics where you live. And I'm wondering if you have talked about that issue with other critical scholars of universities.
So I'll say, you know, at certain points in my career, I was much more active in the local community. At Virginia Tech, you know, I certainly led students in research on displacement and redevelopment in the Blacksburg community. Blacksburg, where Virginia Tech is, a small town, about 40,000 people, most of whom are university students and affiliates. It's really a company town, and it's hard to kind of rally the populace and residents to oppose the university in that setting. However, I'm also involved in a kind of a new research project on redlining and having students work on redlining research and local history on restrictive covenants, for example, and seeing the kind of work that university students and university faculty have done in other places about their local community. You know, I've seen that it can make a difference. It can empower local organizations or local residents. It can change the kind of dynamic between the community, the like student group or the community sensitive university members and the university administration. And so I would say both from seeing my in my own research, but also drawing on the wide array of community-engaged forms of scholarship that are ongoing today. I believe in it, and I believe in what it can do. And, I mean, I would say, looking at some of the protest actions, we'll say, of the 1950s and 1960s, we can see that direct action protest works, right? We can't say it's perfect. We can't say the protesters get everything they want, but we can definitely see that there were significant victories from some of the anti-segregation, some of the anti-development protests. I'll never forget when I realized that Bernie Sanders led an occupation of the University of Chicago for several weeks and got some real concessions from the university. Related to my current research in Minneapolis in Hennepin County, Minnesota, the Mapping Prejudice Project out of the University of Minnesota is a model for community engaged research that is informed and helps shape public policy. The Minneapolis and Hennepin County master plan incorporates the findings of the Mapping Prejudice Restrictive Covenant Research Group in really meaningful ways to kind of affirmatively take on the legacy of racial segregation. The kind of work that people have done with my own collaborative research project in mapping inequality on redlining in the Homeowners Sloan Corporation, is also extremely meaningful. And what I would say is that the key goal has to be community change and political change, not publication. Any kind of publication, whether it be print publication, digital publication, or any kind of community engagement release, has to be, if you want your research to be effective, it's got to have community impact and community values at the center, rather than like faculty advancement or university recognized publication. You know, sometimes those things can come along with it. But if you want to make your academic work relevant to the community and take on like community engagement projects, you've got to put community at the heart of it and not university recognized publication.
Are you then prioritizing those digital projects over future monographs or articles, or how do you see it? How do you see those priorities of yours affecting your work in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll tell you how it like worked out for me, how I think it can kind of work in the future, and then how I am approaching research and publication going forward. When I was working on building the Ivory Tower, I formed a collaboration with a number of scholars, and we released the Mapping Inequality Project on the mapping and security survey work of the Homeowners Loan Corporation, popularly known as like the origins of redlining. And when I went up for tenure, like I had a son who was just a couple of years old. I was a widower because my first wife had passed away. And the absolute most important priority in my life was securing an income and making sure that I could provide like a viable upbringing for my son. And so tenure was the absolute most important way to get about that. To go about that. And so I could not, I think in good conscience, de-emphasize or advocate someone in that case to do something other than publishing a tenure book. Now, my own conscience and my own excitement over the project led me to basically pursue the redlining project and building the Ivory Tower at the same time. And I knew that there would be little recognition of mapping inequality in my tenure package. I gave talks to the faculty and, you know, tried to work with my chair to make the case that this community engaged scholarship had engagement with secondary research. It had primary source archival work, and it had community impact and recognition in cities across the country at its heart. All the things that we care about for like university and faculty publication. So in my mind, they were kind of equal priority for my purposes, for my intellectual life and my, you know, kind of thinking about the impact of my work on the world. My department and my university accepted mapping inequality as an asterisk, the digital project as an asterisk, or, you know, I kind of made the case that it should informally take the place of, you know, another article or two I would have done. And we've kind of formalized that in our tenure and promotion guidelines now. But it's a no-brainer. It's not even close how much more impact mapping inequality has had than building the Ivory Tower. And I say that as a person who wanted to be a published author, and that's why I made why I went to graduate school, why I made it through graduate school, why I made it through the junior faculty years as a widower with a young son. You know, because I believed in what a book could do for intellectual life and for a career and for understanding how we can understand the world around us. Going forward, you know, I've thought somewhat more broadly about audience and impact. I don't think that means not pursuing books. And stemming from or flowing out of the digital work on mapping inequality and some of my other digital mapping work, I'm writing a book on kind of the origins and the implementation, and then the activism against redlining. Well, I'll call it like simply the rise and fall of redlining in an explicit federally directed sense. I'm not prioritizing a university press as the publication because, you know, I think, you know, I want a broad swath of the population to want to and be able to read and relate to the story of how we, you in the, like, as the American public and with federal agencies at the heart of it, kind of institutionalized racial segregation in spatially and in home finance. Kind of a popularly oriented book is my next major research project. If that gets me to full professor, great. I think it would and should, and I'm going to make the case, but you know, I don't care if that one does or something else does. Now, I would not so cavalierly advocate that any other junior faculty member or someone coming out of graduate school, pursue those same priorities. And I was extremely fortunate in almost all ways to kind of have the security, the support of family and friends. I guess I also, I lucked out. I didn't think I would get a tenure track job and didn't think I would actually, become a university professor. And so that gave me a little more willingness to, take risks. Also as a, kind of middle-class white dude, I certainly faced fewer barriers, and I'm sure all audiences were more willing to listen to my case that some of these alternate modes of publication and scholarship should count and are evidence of real impact. I think within the academy and within history departments and the historical profession, we have to be open to different modes. We can be medium agnostic about publication and what that means for people's career. And I think we need to think a little more abstractly about what we really prioritize in evaluating scholarship, whether it be community engaged scholarship or whether it be discipline focused scholarship. And so I think broadening the criteria for tenure and promotion and, even thinking about like tenure and promotion as not being the be all and end all of the construction and development of historical knowledge. I swear I learned as much from, members of local historical societies, from archivists, and from popular authors as I did from, scholarly authors and research professors. And so recognizing that their work is essential to all modes of the production of historical knowledge, I think is useful in rethinking what scholarship looks like.
I agree that conceiving of intellectual work broadly is going to be increasingly important as the job market continues to dry up and as people, scholars who care about issues of popular justice seek to produce work that is meaningful. So I very much look forward to seeing what that second trade press book looks like and exploring mapping inequality. And I really appreciate you sitting down to talk with me today, Wadail. Thank you so much.
Sure. And let me take one more stab at maybe being a little more concise with my last answer, which is that, you know, I think a tenure track job at a research university or a small liberal arts college is not the be all and end all of the historical profession for people with advanced degrees or PhDs. And I think, you know, it's, we can't count on that as a major or meaningful, or certainly the main career path for people with history PhDs and graduate education in history. I think we all should think about what our real impact on the world is, whether it be the local community, whether it be dispersed impact on public policy, and whether whether satisfying our colleagues from an earlier generation is the top priority of historical scholarship. I submit that it is not. Just as I said that community members and student groups within universities, if they make a big enough impact, then university administrators will have to follow along. And I think with if individual members of the faculty, as well as, you know, like people in contingent status, you know, if they can illustrate and have been illustrating the very meaningful impact of their scholarship and their wide array of outputs, and I think the rest of the academic community will follow along. I don't mean to put the onus or responsibility on people in contingent positions, but I think we're seeing really excellent work from people who do online magazines or journals, for example, who do podcasts and these modes of synthesizing and translating and relating scholarship, as well as the kind of alt act type of work that people use, that people, positions that people have to publish their research in alternate formats can be, a very meaningful and significant and impactful way to lead the rest of the higher education community and historical discipline along.
Thank you so much for that. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate you sitting down with me today.
It's been a pleasure, Patrick.